Can you guys hear me in the back?
You can.
Okay. All right. It's my understanding that this is the last lecture of this part of the series, and I'm the last speaker, so this better be good. Professor Tamash said that it's going to be a certain choreography for this evening. Let me begin with two confessions. I'm not a tap dancer, so don't expect any choreography. And even better, I'm not a mathematician. So I'm not sure why I've been invited here, but hopefully I'll say something that's interesting. So before I start, let me thank Professor Terlaki and the Fields Institute for inviting me. And let me also thank a bunch of people at IBM Watson with whom I've had many, many interesting discussions. It's completely amazing to me that when I went to these people and talked to them about what we can do to make mathematicians and engineers work better together to solve chip design problems, it was like opening the floodgates. They all had opinions, and they had lots of opinions. So this seems to be a topic that stirs up a lot of interest in people. So what I'm going to do is to give you some of my opinions on this topic, and this is going to be a very non-technical talk, so you don't really have to take notes or anything. So let me just take a straw poll here. One of the things I've been doing recently is when I come across an idiom or a saying, I try to ask myself, where did that come from? And so I ask myself, where does the word straw poll come from? And it turns out that to determine which way the wind is blowing, people would take a piece of straw and throw it in the air, and they'd find out in which direction the wind was blowing. That's where the name comes from. So let's see where the wind is blowing here. How many of you, by a show of hands, consider yourselves to be mathematicians? Okay. How many of you here consider yourselves to be engineers? Not bad. How many people consider yourself to be realists? None, obviously. Proves my point. Luckily, I prepared two full talks. Okay, talk number one there is for a preponderance of mathematicians, and talk number two is for a preponderance of engineers. So I'm going to use my handy-dandy gyroscope here and move up to the preponderance of mathematicians, and we get into that talk. So here's the outline of what I'm going to talk about in the next 45 minutes. I'm going to first try to convince you that chip design is nothing but a series of optimization tasks. So for all of you who raised your hand when I said mathematicians, you should be kind of salivating because there's a lot of opportunity. It's not as thankless a job as you might think. So is this really a paradise for formal mathematical algorithms? And I will make the argument that no, it's not. I'd further make the argument that despite all of Andy's contributions and eloquence, barely 1% of chip design has been influenced by mathematics in any substantial way. So you might ask, why is that? And I think there are several barriers to the use of mathematics in chip design. And some of the barriers have to do with the characteristics of the problem to be solved. Some have to do with aspects that are a little bit more subjective, like, you know, messy problems versus elegant problems, and more practical considerations versus theoretical. And some have to do with people. We're people, we have feelings, and we approach things in certain ways, and I believe that comes in the way of making progress very often. And I'm going to give some examples and spend some time on that. The next thing I'm going to do is try to tell you that practice is just way far ahead of theory. We solve problems with millions of variables. We lay out 10 million objects. We test circuits that have billions of patterns through them. And you guys can't shake a stick at any of that. Okay? So practice is just way, way, way far ahead. Doesn't mean we're doing it optimally. The fact that we cannot solve these problems correctly forces the engineers to adopt an incremental approach. I made a chip last time. It seemed to work. I'm going to tweak that same design a little bit more. Then you get this little thought, but I could add another multiplier and get rid of this. I could lay them out differently. And then you say, don't even try. Because there's no rigorous analysis or optimization that allows you to understand. And so the evolution of chip design is very, very incremental because the mathematicians are not helping us put the formal basis that we need to understand trade-offs properly. And I'm going to try to convince you of that. And finally, I think that if we have to solve this problem, we will see the evolution of a new species. Darwinism is alive. And I'm going to call this new species a mingenier, which is, and I'll talk about what a mingenier is and what traits such a person should have to be able to contribute successfully to chip design and at the same time bring some formal or rigorous mathematical thinking. And if we're able to do that, I think there's a huge amount of opportunities looking ahead. So this is going to be the outline of what I'm going to talk about. Okay? So let me just begin and talk about chip design methodology a little bit. Now, my first tendency was to show a photograph of a chip and say, there's 100 million transistors there. Each one is so fine, we can put 600 of them in one human hair. And it's 150 watts, and it's 1,500 pins, and so on. But all of you have seen these pictures. All of you know this stuff, okay? So I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to try to make a particular point about how these chips are designed and how they are put together. Typically, you start with high-level design. So your high-level design is, what is the purpose of this chip? What's it meant to do? And maybe you start thinking about, I need four multipliers, I need two processor cores, I need an A to D converter. You start just thinking about what high-level blocks you need in order to make the chip function the way you would like. The next step is some kind of logic design, right? Now, obviously, in high-level design, it's an optimization problem. You're trying to satisfy some high-level specification, and you're trying to use as few resources as possible. Right? You then go into logic design, and here you try to write by means of a high-level description or Boolean equations the actual logical behavior of each piece of your circuit. And this is an optimization problem because you would like your Boolean equations to have as few literals in them as possible. Each literal typically becomes an AND gate or an OR gate or inverter of some kind. So it's an optimization problem. Once you have your logic design, you have to do some kind of floor planning so that all these boxes fit together within some reasonable area. And so you would like these boxes to fit in as small an area as possible. You would like your critical connections between them to be as short as possible. You would like no overlap between these boxes. Sounds to me like an optimization problem. Once you have the floor plan set up, you have to do some amount of circuit design. And there again, you have to optimize the logic part of it. You have to optimize the sizes of all the transistors, as Andy described. And once you have a circuit design, you have to reduce that to shapes, pieces of diffusion, pieces of oxide, pieces of metal. And there again, you're trying to pack things in as best as possible, but not so tightly that the signals interfere with each other. You're optimizing all along. Once you have a layout, you have to do the routing. It's very, very important that your critical signals stay as short as possible. Once you have routing, at some point you're finished with all of the physical design, you go into manufacturing, and once you get back your chips, you have to do some tests. And test is a very, very hard optimization problem because I want to put my chip on the tester for as little time as possible. It's very, very expensive. And I want the best possible coverage of understanding whether there's something wrong or bad with my chip. Logically, functionally, parametrically, in terms of timing, in terms of power. And I want to do this with as little time on the tester as possible. So I would submit to you that this is just a long series of optimization problems. In mainstream chip design today, and I do not include microprocessors because they're very specialized, in mainstream chip design today, we do not use any formal mathematical optimization methods in any of these steps. I don't know if you consider that good news or bad news, But you guys have not made a dent. You haven't even started. Okay? So it's an opportunity, right? So let's cheer up. There's a lot to be done. Yeah. Yeah. So for the purposes of the audio tape, I'm just going to repeat the question, if you don't mind. So the question was, can you get to the test stage without actually building the chip? The answer is yes, absolutely. So even before we build the chip, we try to come up with the right vectors or the input stimulus in order to test this circuit. And if we find that we get very poor coverage and it's taking too long on the tester, we redesign the circuit so it's more testable. So DFT, or design for test, is a huge field. And the way we typically do this is we make every sequential element in the circuit scannable. And scannable means that the sequential circuit has two modes of operation, normal function and test mode. And in test mode, what you can do is to actually make that sequential element observable and controllable. You can scan in some value and scan out whatever value that sequential element gets. So if you make everything scannable everywhere, you can test anything you want relatively easily, but you've paid an overhead in area and an overhead in power, right? So it's a big field. It's a big field. You're battling exponentials there. It's an exponential number of paths. Each of them can be impacted in its delay by an exponential number of corners of the process space due to variation in manufacturing. It's a very, very difficult problem. Now, once you've done your high-level design, you start doing your logic design, and you realize how bad your high-level design is. This is very typical, right? Everything looks rosy, and you go to the next step, and suddenly, what was I thinking? That was a stupid idea. So very often, what you have to do is to go back one step in the methodology, revisit what you did, and come back. And this can happen almost anywhere. And sometimes, as this gentleman pointed out, you can get all the way to the end and say, this chip is not testable. I don't care how good your design is. We're not going to make the chip if it's not testable. Right? So sometimes you have to go back two steps. Sometimes you have to go back three steps. And of course, being human beings, we mess up all the time. We sometimes go back four steps and so on. Right? So a methodology chart typically looks like a rat's nest. And what I've spared you in this picture is the fact that we take big chips and divide them into pieces, and each piece goes through this entire stuff. And then there's partial integration of the pieces at every level over here, right? So just think about some of the opportunities here if we could do this somewhat ad hoc procedure in a more formal way. Question in the back? I guess the question was, how can a chip not be testable? Well, it could take so much effort on the tester to find a flaw that it's not practical that you find all the flaws. So suppose I tell you, I'm going to give you 2 minutes on the tester per chip, which is a lot of time, right? You can only run so many patterns through it, right? And if all of them work, you think this is a good chip, you ship it. And then you start having problems in the field, right? I mean, Intel makes great chips, but you know they've had big problems with some of their chips in the past. So building testability, it doesn't mean that it's not testable. Anything is testable given infinite amount of time, right? The question is it testable in some reasonable manner? And what you really like are tests where you just turn the thing on and it just fails to operate. You would love that rather than for you to have to work very hard to prove that a chip has some problem in it. Testability is an important issue. So here we have this kind of ad hoc scheme where you move up and down these levels of high-level design down to all of the little details, right? And something a little bit more realistic is shown in this page, right? And these are actual methodology charts. So up on the top here, you see 250 nanometers down to 65 nanometers. This indicates the effective length of the transistor. So these are succeeding generations of technology. What we're manufacturing now is in 65 nanometers. And one of the interesting things that's happening in the way we put these chips together is those different steps of the methodology are starting to get smooshed. It's a very scientific term. They're getting smooshed. They're getting, in other words, when you do the layout, you actually do the routing in the inner loop, because otherwise you end up with wires that are too long. When you do the logic optimization, you consider the timing, right? So these different levels are being considered simultaneously. And as you can see here, maybe you can't see it very well, but what used to be separate tools and separate steps in the flow are now getting combined, right? In other words, you're doing more and more simultaneous optimization as you move forward. So is this really a mathematician's paradise? And I got to thinking, what does a mathematician's paradise look like? Now, not being a mathematician, I could only try to imagine. So I was imagining these two mathematicians with their Fields medals hanging from their shirts, walking through the Black Forest in some conference that they have in Germany, and kind of mildly insulting each other in some funny way, right? And so this was just my view of mathematician's paradise. Maybe it's really far from the truth. But anyway, the question is, I mean, the electronics industry is huge, and if we can use mathematics to do something better, and we're not doing it now, right? There's a gigantic opportunity, right? So this is as close to paradise as it comes. Imagine mathematicians who are actually useful. I mean, mind-blowing. It'd be fantastic, right? All that good brain power could actually be put to good use, right? But I actually think there's one more aspect that should make you guys salivate even more. And that is the whole concept of variability. So the way we are manufacturing chips today, we're making the line features that we print on these chips smaller and smaller and smaller. Our control of the size of these features is getting worse and worse and worse proportionately. Therefore, what we manufacture at 65 nanometers is going to have more variability in it than what we could manufacture at 90 or 130. Our control is going to hell in a handbasket. That's not stopping us from making chips, by the way. Question in the back? We are using every trick in the bag, including lithography techniques. Absolutely. So the question was, looks like we're using lithography techniques. Yes. So let me just run through these pictures very quickly. The top left picture over here, if this is the shape that you intend to print, because of the diffraction of light and all kinds of other physics, this is the shape that you actually obtain on the actual circuit when you do the printing, right? And therefore, as was pointed out, you pre-distort the layout in all kinds of interesting ways to try to print true to what you really want. This next picture is actually very, very interesting. So this is a Monte Carlo simulation of a single transistor. The blue regions over here are the source and drain. The red region is the gate. And remember that when the gate gets turned on, the electrons flow across and a connection is made. Now what's interesting about this simulation is that every single atom and molecule has been simulated here, right? So we're at the point where we're actually counting how many donors and acceptors are in there. And the number of acceptors that are actually setting the threshold voltage of this device, the voltage at which it will start to conduct, is a few hundred. And you simply cannot escape the statistics that go with putting down 100 atoms of something. It's going to be 100 plus or minus a lot. Right? When it used to be 100,000, it was not a problem. When it's 100, right, there's statistics there that you simply cannot ignore. Look at the picture on the top right. That's a cross-section of the gate region of a transistor. And you see the molecular grain boundaries jumping up and down. So just within the gate of a single transistor, I'm not looking across transistors or across chips or across wafers or batches, within one transistor, I'm going from 2.2 nanometers to 2.6, 20% variation within one transistor. And you still have to make chips that work. Picture on the bottom shows CMP, or chemical mechanical polishing effects, whereby you lay down wires, you put some oxide, you polish everything. You put more wires, you polish everything. And it turns out that when there's a large density of wires in one region, but not a lot in the other region, you get dishing effects. And that changes the resistance and the capacitance. And that changes the signal time, the propagation time. And you have to make chips that work despite all of these variations. So it's not just an optimization problem, lick your chops. It's a stochastic optimization problem. We love that, right? So here's an interesting way of looking at what variability is doing to mainstream chip design, right? On the y-axis here is performance. On the x-axis are different technology generations, like 130 nanometers, 90, 65, and so on. Performance is supposed to just keep going up exponentially. That's a version of Moore's law. What's happening, however, is that you get these vertical bars on each of these, and these vertical bars show the uncertainty or the variability in the performance that you get. And this is just a schematic drawing. Don't read too much into the size of these bars, but they're just getting bigger and bigger. And mainstream chip design, which is very cost sensitive and cannot afford to have bad chips, is following the bottom curve, right? Because you want to make a design that is safe, that will not malfunction despite all of this variability. And interestingly, what's happening now is that scaling is sort of starting to taper off. So what's happening is that this nice exponential, So this nice exponential growth here is starting to taper off because we simply are hitting certain limits in physics, right? So now look what happens. The worst case from the previous technology to the worst case in the next technology may be a very small improvement in performance unless you do something different. Everybody's going ahead and investing, $2 billion, $3 billion in moving to the next technology. And we'd better get some performance out of it and not something as shown over here. So solving these stochastic optimization problems turns out to be an extremely important problem in chip design. So let's go to the next piece of the talk, which is what are the barriers, right? What is preventing all you very, very smart people from influencing reality in chip design, right? This is actually a very difficult question to ask. It's a difficult question to answer. So I'm just going to put up some thoughts on what I think the barriers may be. And I'm sure you have your own opinions on this, and maybe this will start some discussion and some debate, and maybe you guys will come and beat me up afterwards, but so be it. Here are my thoughts. I think it's true that a lot of the problems that we solve are NP-hard or pound-P-hard, and a lot of you just look at it and say, this NP-hard, not interesting, right? And the truth of the matter is that many of these problems are messy. They're messy in the sense you can't even formulate them in a clean way, right? Nonetheless, be aware that it's very, very important to some engineers that these problems be solved, and with or without your help, they will come up with some solution. It doesn't have to be optimal. They will come up with some solution. The second reason, I think, is this whole notion of, you know, is it theoretically interesting? Is this a good use of my time, right? And similarly, from the engineer's point of view, should I spend time learning these trust regions or whatever it is you guys are talking about? Is it going to lead anywhere? Because guess what? May 15th, I have to finish my chip design. So there's a very, very practical constraint there. And finally, most importantly, I believe that there are some biases or cultural traits or whatever you want to call it. I want to be politically correct, but at the same time point out that people think differently, they use different languages, they have different priorities, they approach problems differently, they decide what problem is worth their time a little bit differently, they use different software techniques, they go to different conferences, and I believe that this is a big reason why all the brain power that exists in mathematics and all the body of knowledge has failed to make any impression on mainstream chip design. So let's talk about these a little bit. So let's talk about just language problems. So how would an engineer define optimum? Optimum, not optimal, optimum. Good enough. Pretty much, right? The chip is due tomorrow, right? I have a power limit of 150 watts. I think I'm at 149. Man, this is optimum. It's good enough, right? I'm just trying to point out that there's a difference in how people think and approach this. And the mathematician will think of this as the one and only best solution under all circumstances, no matter what happens, right? So what is optimal? Optimal for an engineer is really the best that I can do. And it doesn't matter how flawed this person is. It doesn't matter how dumb this person is. I worked on it the best I could do. It's optimal. So what does a mathematician think? This is the best solution in an irrelevantly small neighborhood of the problem. That's optimal. Right? The point there is that neither of these is really very helpful. Right? And when these two guys talk, they misinterpret very simple words. And right there, things start to go wrong a little bit. So what's global convergence? It's a global optimum, right? The best thing. Oh, no, it's a local optimum, but I can get to it starting from anywhere. That's what global convergence is, right? There's a lot of difference. What about numerical noise? Well, it's just part of life, right? Any calculation on a computer has numerical noise. And, well, not really interesting, it's messy. The Hessians get unbounded. It's just completely, totally irrelevant. So, we heard a big theorem in the previous talk, right? And the whole theorem was based on the fact that as you take a smaller and smaller region in space, a simple linear approximation or a quadratic approximation gets better and better. I hate to tell you this, that's false. The smaller the region, the crappier your model. Okay? So, you take a very accurate tool like SPICE, you give it a little circuit and say, what's the delay of the circuit? 20.8464.9494 picoseconds. Okay? I'm going to change the width of one transistor by 0.000001 microns. Now, what's the delay again? It's going to give you a garbage change in the delay. Right? Because it's doing time stepping, it's doing Newton iteration, it's got convergence tolerances, it's got all kinds of stuff. So, my point is, as soon as your algorithm gets in trouble and the region gets small, you're hosed. Now, I understand that I couldn't write a SIAM journal paper with that as a theorem, but that is reality. Okay? So, question in the back. Right. So we say that. Right. So I guess the question is that there may be some enlightened mathematicians that actually understand that there's some limitations to making the region smaller and smaller. And in fact, if I make my region 1e-64, I can't even represent it on a computer with any ease. Right. So obviously there's limitations on this. You can't even represent it. But my point is we lightly write theorems and continue writing theorems, right? When we know this is false. Thank you very much. These theorems don't apply in practice. Okay. So, I will take it as a fact of life that theorems are meant to be toys that you play with. Okay? Okay, that's fine. And it's true, and I think we should understand when these theorems have limitations. It's still useful to make an assumption and then prove something, but when that assumption is blatantly wrong, then it's not terribly useful to rely on the result. Therefore, it turns out to be an intellectually stimulating exercise. Right? No, nothing wrong with that. Simulation's good. Right? So, moving on here, what about finite precision arithmetic? It's in some sense related to noise, right? Because at certain precision, you get garbage from a computer, right? So, you know, engineers shrug their shoulders. Adapt, tax is finite precision. You can't avoid any of these things. And, of course, I haven't seen a lot of papers in the optimization space that are really worrying about finite precision arithmetic and what it does to your algorithms. So, I mean, don't take this as a critique to heart. I'm not a mathematician. I'm just pointing out some things I've observed over the years. So, yeah. Now we're getting somewhere. Okay. Coming. We'll get there. Because they were built by engineers, too. But, yeah, okay. Yes, absolutely right. So I think we should put the pure mathematicians on that side, the applied mathematicians on this side, and get the engineers to kneel in the aisle, and then continue. Okay.
A point of history, I'm not sure you're aware, but I think the reason IBM exists is because of the mathematicians. And that's Zsolt Kahan in the 60s. There was a lot of computing companies, and Zsolt Kahan came up with one of his projects, which involved finite precision. There were many companies who couldn't handle the unknown data, couldn't handle the finite precision. I think many people say that the reason IBM took off, the reason why the cost of the company was because
So the comment here is that there was an IBM mathematician who actually established a standard for dealing with finite precision in computations like multiplication and division, and that allowed computers to become successful and usable. And I would point out that most of my comments don't apply to IBM mathematicians, of course, except Andy. And secondly, I do think that this is an example of an exception that made a lot of difference in real life. And the question is, how can we have more mathematicians that make huge contributions, right? And we'll talk about some of the traits of such people as we move forward. So all of this was to poke fun, so don't take it all that seriously. Yeah, question in the back. There's different groups of engineers, that's true, but they're all a lesser species, all of them. No, it's true. It's absolutely true. And I think that there are engineers who are a little bit more mathematically oriented or who understand logic and the power of, you know, mathematical algorithms, and there are those who don't care. So, yes, I would agree with that. So we'll try to classify these people before the end of the evening, we'll rearrange everybody or something. Okay, so let's go on. There is a human side to optimization. For crying out loud, we have built machines that play chess better than any known human being. Can we not design a machine that designs a circuit? For crying out loud, right? And so here we have these engineers who have spent years and years and years designing circuits, and you come up to them and say, I have it. I have a program. You just tell it what you want, press the button, it'll design the circuit for you. Guess what the first reaction you're going to get will be? Right? Surely, I'm better than a machine, right? So what they're going to do is run your program, get some result, and then try to improve on the result. Right? And then say your program is useless. And this happens all the time, right? And the first 10 times, they're actually right. They get a better answer than your program. Because all the theorems notwithstanding, the code doesn't work very well, and there is a better answer. Okay? The 11th time, however, they violate one of their own constraints and get a better answer. It's a better answer, except they just violated one of their own constraints. Now, if the mathematician guy is interacting with the engineer, he's likely to say, are you crazy? You can't compete with the machine. Look at all my theorems. For any m greater than n, there exists a delta less than epsilon, such that in the limit, blah, blah, blah. And the engineer guy who developed this code, talking to the designer, right, who's feeling a little bit upset that, you know, he couldn't beat the machine, says, I agree with you. These machines are so dumb. Doesn't it know that the power can't exceed 100 milliwatts? Right? So in other words, there's a way to get people to try to accept that machines do things better than them. Right? And the human side of this, I think, is terribly important for these techniques to be adopted in practice. Right? And the problem we face over and over and over again is that there are tacit constraints. This transistor must be above that one, and your program put it below. Like, you can't do that. Well, you didn't tell me. Right? Well, there's no way in your program for me to tell you. You mean you have to tell? I have to tell you for every pair of transistors? What? This, we go through this all the time, right? So there are tacit constraints in every single real life problem, and it's like pulling teeth to get it out of the engineer and express it to the optimization problem. And so no matter what solution you come up with, it does not satisfy all the tacit constraints, so it can't be useful, it can't be worthwhile. So the exercise of formulating the thing well is 90% of the battle. Very, very important. And what you need to convince these designers is that optimization brings a certain promise. The promise that it brings is you don't have to do the grunt work of adjusting the diameter of every pipe, adjusting the width of every transistor. You don't have to do that. Shift your thinking to something higher level. Shift your thinking to how best to pose the problem and leave it to the machine to solve it for you. Automate the grunt work. Be more productive in your design. And in fact, you can be faster, smarter, more productive if you use this as a tool. And when you can finally get the designer to say this, saying this to the designer doesn't help. When you get them to say it, right, then you've really achieved something in terms of their adoption of some optimization technique. Software techniques, I think, are terribly, terribly important, and they often get neglected. Most computer-aided design or design automation tools are programmed in C++, typically large pieces of software with fairly rigorous coding standards, and a lot of mathematicians are still using Fortran, so that turns out to be a problem. DLL versus static linking, I mean, most big pieces of software are just compiled into little dynamically loadable objects. And most math tools I know don't use that paradigm. They just statically link all their objects together. Most math programs I know, at the optimization level, think of themselves as the master of the world. They will call somebody to get a function value. They will call somebody to get a gradient. But they are the main program. Main is right in there. And guess what? Most of these programs end up being the slave of some other program. And they're just ill-architected to be the slave of some other program. They're ill-architected to handle more than one optimization problem at a time. You can't just instantiate another object of this class and solve two problems in memory at the same time. You just can't do it. You're not architected to say, wipe your slate clean, and now here's a new optimization problem. Solve it for me. These are not hard things to do in software. It's just that people don't seem to architect their code that way. Scripting is another thing. Almost any engineering software today uses some scripting language that allows the user to do many different interesting things with the code, with many different entry points into the code, right? And this is not a paradigm that's often used in the mathematical world. A lot of math tools read text files or tokenized files that describe constraints or nodes in the graph or whatever. They read files. And it's not useful to read files anymore. Just provide me a programming interface where I say, here's a node, here's a constraint, here's a lower bound, here's a whatever, right? And you can always have a layer of code that reads that from a file and calls your API, but provide the API in a clean, documented way. Now, throwaway code is another interesting thing. Almost every chip that we make, we write tons of code to help us do that design, and then we throw it away. And mathematicians, from what I've seen, once they write code, they just cling onto it forever and ever and ever and ever. Yeah, there's bit rot. It's in COBOL. I don't know. But they just cling on to. It's just a different way of thinking of code. To just try something, make it work for this chip, throw it away, because there's a better way to do it for the next chip, right? The whole output and reports issue, what should an optimization program print? Nothing. The correct answer is nothing. Don't tell me a thing. I don't want to know any. Don't print and don't produce gigabytes of data. Don't tell me the value of the Slack variables. I don't even want you to use Slack variables. I don't even want to know you're using Slack variables. Give me a programming interface where I can ask, what's the optimum solution? Or are there any constraints that were violated at the end? And I will print whatever it is I want to communicate to the designer. Don't print junk. Your constraint names, your Slack variable names, these mean nothing to the program that's calling you, and they in turn mean nothing to the designer that's using the program. Okay. So this whole thought process of how you take an algorithm and reduce it to a piece of software needs to change in a very big way. Question in the back. Somebody disagrees with me, so this is good news. Yeah, I think the question is that I asked previously for a program that will do all the circuit design for me, then why would I throw it away? We throw things away because we recognize that they are of low value. And some people never realize that about their code. That's the point I'm trying to make. Right? So if you really make a very general purpose tool that's excellent at what it does, of course you wouldn't throw it away. You'd use it, right? But if it's really clumsy and awful and has limitations, don't try to tweak it. At some point, just start again. And every time you write a big program new in your life, you do a better job. You architect it better. You learn how to do things better. That's sort of the point I was trying to make. So, just a quick case study here. And I don't have a lot of charts, so don't worry about the time. We heard Andy talking about transistor sizing, right? And this has been one of the very successful programs within IBM where engineers used to spend a lot of time tweaking the sizes of individual transistors in the context of custom design for our microprocessors. And we were able to replace that by an automated method that is more efficient and makes them more productive and so on. However, you know, are we really done? We still have cases where we do not achieve convergence. And of course, immediately, the math side says, that's a gradient, the gradient's bad, obviously. Right? And so the question is, whose fault is it, right? So when there is non-convergence, what is the root cause of that non-convergence? I'd love to see a Cyan paper on that, right? It's just a difficult thing. We'll come to you in a second. It's just a difficult thing to debug these very complicated optimization problems, and I don't see enough hooks in there to help us do good engineering work with some of these programs. In real life, almost every optimization problem is a mixed integer discrete problem. So even transistor sizing, which is as good as it gets for all you continuous types, right, we don't lay out these transistors as one blob of silicon. As shown on the top right, we make multiple fingers. It turns out when you go beyond 1 or 1.5 microns, you don't get a proportional increase of current, because all the current flows in the edges. So what you do is you make multiple of these transistors and just connect them in parallel, like the layout shown over there. SD is source and drain of the transistors. So now, if you go from 4 fingers to 5 fingers, you increase the transistor width from 2.5 microns to 2.6 microns, and suddenly it's 4 fingers. But now you've changed the topology of the circuit. It's a discrete change. All the little parasitic capacitances have changed, and you're really unable to handle it. Pin swapping is another example. Here's the 3-input NAND gate. And it turns out that the A pin has the fastest delay to the output, and the C pin has the slowest delay. So once you tune your circuit and you know your critical path, if it passes through the C pin, then you should just swap the C and A pin because they're logically equivalent. But that's a discrete change, right? And our programs can't handle this. and so on and so on. A very, very interesting question is, what really is the objective function? And in the context of transistor sizing, we've asked ourselves this question for 5 years now, and we've not settled on it yet. Because if all I do is minimize delay, then almost every path in the circuit ends up with the same delay. Because if you're slower than that, you need to be sped up. If you're faster than that, I'll steal area and power from you and use it somewhere else. So you get this wall of equally critical paths. And if you have any little variability in manufacturing, you're screwed. So what you want to do is break down the wall. So ideally, you want to say, things that are very critical, pour your resources on them, make them better. Things that are a little bit less than critical, keep them away from the edge. And things that are way subcritical, steal area and power from them. Well, try making an objective function out of that that actually works in practice. So my point is, we seem to think we know what an objective function should be for an engineering problem, but it almost never is what you think it should be. It takes years sometimes to really refine that. Now, the beauty is, if I'm using heuristic methods, every time there's a new objective function, I need a new algorithm or I need some new intuition to solve it. Whereas with mathematics, you know, I can express a new objective function fairly quickly. So that's the good news here. And in fact, in terms of circuit tuning, we're on the fourth version of our software and counting. So this is not a done problem by any means. And in fact, here's an important question. When is a project complete? The answer is A, when the SIAM paper gets accepted. Well, you know what I'm going to pick. Okay. B, when the chip is shipped. Or C, when the first version works on the very first test case. Right? And so on. So the point is that the engineers need to stick with it until it works smoothly on every chip with every exception, whereas the mathematicians typically say, oh, it works. I'm done. It's not interesting anymore because there's no publications left here, so let me go and do something else, right? And it's a big difference. It's an impedance mismatch between these sets of people. So I won't belabor this point, but mathematicians construct beautiful theories and beautiful algorithms. It all sounds like a beautiful symphony, but what happens in real life is that noise, numerical noise, comes into the picture, and then all your Hessian boundedness and things getting more accurate as you get smaller. I've already said this to you. So why do we not study numerical noise? Why do we not make algorithms that are good in the presence of numerical noise? Why do we not come up with a proof that says this will converge provided the norm of the noise is less than some amount or whatever, right? So it just seems to me that this is begging for some formal treatment that at least I haven't seen. Here's another interesting aspect, failure. That's not the grade I'm giving to anybody in this room, by the way. So failure to me means I'm trying to optimize something. I have to evaluate the function. I typically do that by calling a simulator or a layout tool or a logic minimization, some tool. And that tool comes back and says, I couldn't measure what you wanted me to measure. You wanted the time at which the output signal rises. And you know what? The output signal didn't even rise. It just went up 100 millivolts and came back down. It didn't go up to 1 volt. What are you going to do? Right? So here's a case where you've moved the parameters of the optimization problem within the simple bounds, but into some bad region where the circuit just doesn't operate anymore. How do you recover from that? Right? I don't know. Again, I don't see any formal treatment of this kind of, right? I mean, it's a very, very practical problem, but I don't see any clean solution to any of this. So I'm going to kind of end up here by showing you some visualizations, and hopefully you'll find this kind of fun. The point I'm making here is that any optimization problem deals with reams and reams and reams of data, right? You have 20,000 variables, you do 800 iterations, and in every iteration these variables take some value and so on. And trying to visualize what's happening in your algorithm is extremely useful to find out if things are working the way you would like it to work. So I'm going to show you I'm just going to show you one visualization now. I'll skip the other one in the interest of time. If there's interest, I can show it afterwards. So here's the visualization, which is the clock distribution problem that Andy was talking about. Now, that's the kind of problem where people would gladly give up their firstborn for 10 picoseconds, right? So if you can reduce the skew of the clock by 10 picoseconds, it's worth tremendous amounts, right? So in this picture, the X and Y axis are actually X and Y on a small little portion of the chip. The Z axis is time. And through a series of wires and buffers, you take the clock from a central location and try to distribute it to various locations. At each of these locations, the load that you're driving is unequal, so you get mismatch in the delay, and delay is the z-axis here. And then you run an optimization program to tweak the width of these wires, which is really shown like width, and the color coding really is the current density through them, until you try to equalize all of this. And let me try to show you. What I did is to capture what the optimization program is doing at every iteration of the optimization and make a little screenshot, right, so that you can see in an animated fashion, you know, what this optimization algorithm is doing until it ends up balancing everything. And you might think to yourself, oh, what a silly little exercise. This guy wanted to see a movie and he made a little movie, right? The truth of the matter is that this kind of visualization is extremely, extremely useful to really understand what your algorithm is doing. I'm going to skip the other one. So here's something a little bit more realistic, where you have a clock source, buffers, wires, and you finally have the clock being distributed. This is approximately 1/4 of the power 4 chip that we did about a couple of years ago. So you start to see more realistically what this problem looks like. And here's an example of how this visualization helps you. The first time we did the visualization, this is what came up. And we realized that there were some of these resistances that were being modeled incorrectly in the optimization program. And so you got this kind of jump in time. And you say, oops, there's a bug. Now, I don't know how many gigabytes of data you'd have to ream through before you could understand this, but your eye is just so good at looking at this and saying, something's wrong, right? So I do think that most engineers that I know like visualizations and like drawing pictures, and that helps them understand things. And the mathematicians I know are less likely to do the work to produce pictures like this. Here's another case where we did an animation of what would happen if I took one wire and bumped up its voltage to VDD at one end. VDD is the high voltage, okay? And trying to understand what happens to all of the surrounding wires. The surrounding wires get coupled and they move. And we found floating wires. We found vias missing. We found the other rail taking a little droop. Right? There's all kinds of interesting things you see when you visualize your algorithms. And to me, there's a lot of power in it. And once you debug your program, believe me, these make for the coolest slides. And you can wow any audience by showing these beautiful visualizations. And I have many of them to show afterwards if anyone's interested. So very quickly, just a few other issues here. Let me move on to the second bullet here. Asymptotics is something, as Andy said, we never really see. We don't really care about. So I know there's huge bodies of theory on asymptotics. Maybe an algorithm that's good for asymptotics is also good otherwise. So you can wave your hands at that. But we really don't care about asymptotics. Mathematics is very interesting because it's a unifier across disciplines and fields. So the knapsack problem is the same in mechanical engineering as in computer engineering as in electrical. So it gets a name, it gets an algorithm, and everybody can consult it. So that's kind of interesting. The mixed problems are absolutely ubiquitous, and we don't know how to solve them of any reasonable size. Even if we can only solve very, very small problems, they are very useful because we can calibrate heuristics based on that. In fact, preconditioners is another good example where you're doing something rigorously mathematical, but you're using your intuition about the system, right? So there again, math and engineering are playing their role in trying to solve this problem a little bit better. And engineers love simulated annealing. They love genetic algorithms. They love it because it's easy. You can program it in half an hour and it starts to work, gives you a result, right? And I can penalize anything I don't like. I can give incentive to anything I like. It's very, very easy in these programs. And that's why they do it. However, they need to understand that every time they use one of these algorithms, they have admitted to themselves that there's something about the nature of this problem that they don't understand. And that's why they're taking these huge hammers and trying to hit the problem with these. So, last little piece of my talk. I'm trying to make the point here that chip design is a juggernaut. And like the straw poll, I started asking myself, where did this word juggernaut come from? And it was very interesting. The etymology of this word comes from a temple in the state of Orissa in India, where there is a Jagannath temple. And once a year, the deity likes to go for a walk from this temple. And there's these huge chariots with gigantic wooden wheels where the deity is placed on the chariot, and a procession goes through the streets of the town. And the wheels are so big and the chariot is so big and the people pushing it, there's so much momentum that if you're there, you just get crushed. And that's where the word juggernaut comes from. And the reason I put it up here is to say whether or not we have mathematical solutions to a whole variety of problems, we will build the chips. We will build the systems. We will incrementally do better from last time. We will learn something as we go, right? With or without your partnership, with or without your insight. And you need to understand that, because I've often had people say, so you can't solve this problem, what are you going to do? You're going to build a chip? How are you going to do something? Take a guess. You know, we'll make a test chip with 6 different solutions and measure them. We'll do something. Right? So it's very important to understand that this is just going to keep marching forward. There's, you know, nothing going to stop us. So, in answer to some of the questions from the back, I think that there are many different types of mathematicians, and some of them are applied or more likely to be realistic or whatever. And then among the engineers, there are some that are a little more curious or a little more logically oriented. And with a very low probability sometimes, people at these edges crawl through this tunnel where the Fermi barrier is very, very high, and with a random bit of statistics, they somehow get together and do something good. And I think the whole situation needs to be better. And I think there are institutes such as this and IPAM and so on that are devoted to making these sets of people work together. And so I would argue that we need mingineers. And from an engineering side, that means somebody who's not scared of equations, who's reasonably well-versed, at least in basic mathematics, who's willing to dig into the math literature and feel somewhat at home in math conferences, can abstract the problem at hand without using engineering terms, you know, who's interested in general solutions rather than heuristics, and absolutely under no illusions about his or her limitations, because it's pretty important for a collaboration, and in fact has fewer tacit requirements, of somebody who's more willing to state formally the problem that's trying to be solved, and willing to take a sabbatical maybe in a math department so that he understands that they work hard too, and they, you know, work on interesting problems. And from the math side, I think that we need someone who's patient, who's willing to get his or her hands dirty, practical, willing to dig into engineering papers and ask for help when they don't understand something, who can translate mathematical statements into a language that engineers can understand, software savvy, willing to compromise on goals. So you have one less SIAM paper in your CV. It's okay. It's not the end of the world, right? Under no illusion about his or her limitations. The stuff the engineers do is complex too. And sometimes it's just befuddling, but you just have to be patient and work your way through it. And maybe go sit with the engineers for 3 months and sign up to design one tiny corner of their chip, and, you know, someone will bail you out if you can't cut it. So, in conclusion, chip design is a series of optimization tasks. This is very positive. The penetration of math algorithms has been negligible, in my opinion. And I think this is a positive thing because that means it's a huge opportunity. Part of the reason is that we don't have enough people with these engineering skills, and we need to cultivate them a little bit more. And there's a huge, huge potential if we're successful. So what I'm going to leave you is with some inspiration. Do not worry about your difficulties in mathematics. I assure you that mine are greater. This is a poster I have up on my wall, right? I love it. As far as the laws of mathematics refer to reality, they're not certain. And as far as they are certain, they do not refer to reality. This is Einstein's, not me. So. God does not care about our mathematical difficulties. He integrates empirically. And finally, I love this. Since the mathematicians have invaded the theory of relativity, I do not understand it myself anymore. Thank you very much.
Any more questions?